Well, Dave, I'm wondering if we shouldn't start. It seems that the number of joinings and leavings is settling down.
Whenever you say.
Well, I would say,
all right.
Go ahead. I suppose I should just introduce you. This is a briefing on registrar impersonation in phishing attacks. A little afraid of what the interpreters will make of that, but there you go. And we have as our host today Dave Piscitello, who is the staff person for the Security and Stability Advisory Committee, who originated their advisory on this subject recently. And I'll now turn it over to Dave to walk us through his presentation. For those of you who have internet access, we do recommend that you log into the Adobe Connect session for this meeting, available off of the agenda page, as you will then be able to see the presentation as Dave walks us through it. Do you need me to walk through this, Dave, by the way? Or are you doing it? Dave?
Okay, then. Well, as the first slide says, we're going to talk about phishing, and we're going to talk about a particular style of phishing with a rather unusual motive from what most people are accustomed to understanding or appreciating as a phishing attack. So, let's talk about registrar impersonation and to give a little bit of context here, talking about a phishing attack. And a phishing attack is essentially a means of socially engineering an individual through an electronic mail correspondence to do something that he otherwise should not do, to disclose information that he otherwise might not want to disclose, because he's been duped or convinced that there is some need to disclose the information or some need to take an action. We're mostly accustomed to seeing phishing attacks that are associated with some sort of identity theft or fraud or scam or an affiliation with some sort of too-good-to-be-true purchase. Such as a designer watch or enhancement drugs, to be polite. And what we're talking about here is actually a kind of phishing where instead of impersonating a bank or a merchant or an online auction, the attacker actually impersonates a registrar. So instead of the phish email being sent to a bank's customer, the emails are actually sent to a registrar's customer. And there are two forms of this that are very consistent with the way that phishing is performed generally. One is sort of a bulk or net phishing, where the phish emails are sent to as many customers of a registrar that an attacker might be able to collect. And I'll talk about this in is where a particular target is because there's some particularly high value or desirable aspect to targeting a customer. And again, using the phishing analogy, this is called spear phishing. And the targets are typically called whales. In the identity theft world, a whale would be someone who happens to have a large bank account or is perceived to have significant funds because he is listed as the CEO of a company online, and the attacker has actually gone and done some reconnaissance and discovered that this would be a really good spearfish, because if I can't get him to disclose this information, I might be able to get a considerable amount of money of a fraud or an identity theft of that person. If of a targeted customer of a registrar, the attacker is looking for is someone who would have a high-value domain name. Yeah.
Dave, sorry, Sebastian. It's very, very difficult to understand you. I don't know if it's technical, because your voice, it's cut very often. I don't know how we can fix that, but it's really very difficult. Is it not an easy subject? Then if you add technical difficulty, it's not very helpful.
Is everyone having a problem?
Yes.
Just wondering if they shouldn't be using some simultaneous trends. Does that help or not, Sebastian?
No, I am listening to the English channel.
Okay.
Estoy en el canal en inglés.
Okay.
Dave Piscatello.
Left.
Dave, are you using a Skype connection?
He just left.
I think, yeah, he must be dialing in differently.
I am the only one to have this problem, or others have...
No, it was happening to me, too.
Yep, me
okay.
too.
Okay. Because if it's just me, it's me to solve the problem, not the others. If it's more than one, then it could be somebody else.
No, you were the only one smart enough to tell us.
I was talking and realized no one was hearing me because I was on mute.
Yeah, but there is something that says, thanks, Nick. Dave, can you please changing phone? You've got changing phone, which is where he's up to.
Dave.
Joined.
Okay.
Is this any better?
Infinitely.
Yes.
All right. Well, I have the feeling that my BlackBerry Wi-Fi is just not up to grade for a teleconference. So I've switched to a landline.
It's a sad story about our technology, but that's often true.
Well, yeah. You know, it's the difference between 100 years and 20 years. So. Okay, so let me continue on why impersonate a registrar.
Yeah. Yep.
So, you know, one of the reasons why an attacker would impersonate a registrar is to lure a customer into disclosing what are called the domain management account credentials, essentially the username and the password that a domain portfolio administrator might use to acquire domains, to make changes to name servers, to add or renew subscriptions or registrations for a company. The reason why this is so valuable is twofold. One is that the domains may have value for the purpose of hijacking. Another is that the domains may have value for the purpose of abetting other crimes. So let's take a look at that sort of detail in the next slide. I've tried to break this out into a couple of major categories. The first is malicious activities. These would be scenarios where the phisher is actually attempting to attack the registrant or the company that holds the domains. What would you do with the account information if you managed to capture it? Well, one thing you could do is hijack the domain. Even if you can't keep the domain for a very long time, as we've seen with the recent Comcast and even ICANN incidents, what you can do is disrupt the business. You can
do a web defacement. You can do some other form of brand tarnish or impose some embarrassment onto a company. Another one, which is significantly more malicious, is that you can modify some of the DNS records that are accessible through the domain management account of any of the domains. So you could change the mail exchange and funnel mail that is destined for a corporation either into a black hole or into some place where you're capturing it. You could change the internet addresses so that you might be able to redirect web requests and other requests to some sort of phishing attack site or some sort of host that further impersonates not simply the registrar, but now impersonates the company. So, for example, if I could hijack eBay.com and I could make a phishing site look very much like eBay.com, I could capture credentials. Or if I can hijack Citibank, then I can, throw up a bogus login page and I can, try to capture identities of bank customers of Citibank. Another way to impersonate registrants is to do some reconnaissance for attacks that may either be in the virtual world or in the physical world. For example, some information is available, once you access a domain registrant's account that is not published via Whois. Some of that information might be billing information. Some of the information might be other information about domains that the account holder has in some sort of proxy or private service. So reconnaissance is very valuable because it gives you another way to attack a company. Largely, the way that we see registrar phishing and the worry that we have is that once a domain account has been hacked or stolen, the attacker tends to not only use records of existing domains, but add domains by purchasing them with an available credit card information or some sort of customer billing information if it's a high-value customer and they have a purchase order arrangement. And those additional domains are the ones that are used in attacks. So let's walk through a scenario of a registrar phishing attack. One of the things you have to do is lay the framework as an attacker. And so when I say host the deception, this is the part of the attack where you essentially put up the false or deception portal, something that is a convincing duplicate of the registrar's customer portal, looks very much like a GoDaddy or a Register.com or a Network Solutions landing page where you get to do the search and you get to check availability of domain names and you get to log in. So once you've set that up on a machine that you own as an attacker, you then try to acquire your targets. Now, where do you acquire your targets? Well, one of the prime sources of acquiring targets is gathering the contact email addresses for domain names that you intend to attack using the Whois or other methods. Now that you have those two components in place, you need to lure targets to the site. This is where you compose an email, and you want the email to essentially appear to be from the registrar, which is the impersonation part, and also an email that will stimulate or cause the recipient to not think particularly queerly, but think quickly and go to the deception site. So once you've launched those three components, what you essentially do as a phisher is you wait. And this is where you're simply sitting there trying to collect money in the identity theft world, but it's also where in the registrar impersonation world you are waiting to have someone fall prey to your lure, to visit the deception registrar site, and to then try to log in. Once he's logged in, the phisher has the account credentials, and then he can go and he can do any of the malicious activities that we talked about earlier. Let's talk a little bit about the lures. So what fishers do, and what fishers excel in
Chuck
is...
Chuck Gomes.
Left.
What fishers excel in is understanding the dynamics of fear, uncertainty, and doubt. And so the goal of the social engineering that is built into fish emails is to convince people that they have to take action as quickly as possible, to raise an alarm, to make someone think that this is a perfectly legitimate correspondence and I really need to pay attention to it. Well, registrars have a very significant number of expected correspondences. Registrars send out domain name renewal notices, and anyone who cares about a domain name is going to pay attention to the fact that the domain is coming up for renewal. Similarly, if they get a transfer notice, they're going to say, oh my God, I don't want my name transferred, and they're going to perhaps go to the impersonation site and disclose their credentials. An order confirmation of something that you didn't order, this is a typical eBay kind of attack where you would see something saying, you purchased this and you haven't paid for it. Registration request confirmations. This is, again, a change, a request for another registration of a domain. Who is accuracy reminders? Annually, ICANN requires that registrars ask registrants to confirm that the information in the WHOIS is accurate. And then many people actually pay attention to that, and they will say, oh, my goodness, I thought I did this last week. I forgot. And it goes on and on. So not only are there a number of expected correspondences, but one of the things that registrars tend to do for the purpose of convenience and ease of use is to provide some information that the customer can use that he may not necessarily fixed to memory. The registrar will often include information that is a customization or a personalization to assist the customer, and fishers will use that to enhance the deception. So here we have an example, and this is an email that would be processed in TextAsky. There's no HTML here. And it says, thank you for your order. Dear customer, thank you for ordering from your registrar's name, deleted. Here are the details of your recent transaction with us. And if you notice, it has a customer number, and it has a receipt number, and it has an order total, and it has a customer service number. And they all look perfectly benign and perfectly convincing. It then says, please log in. And if you log in to that login name, and there's been a cash poisoning or there's been some other attack that the Fisher has used to actually convince the or to direct the recipient to the deception site, then he's managed to get the registrant to take the lure, and he's managed to get into the deception site, and that will possibly convince the registrant to disclose his credentials. Now, what's very interesting about social engineering is that often the information that's provided in such emails where it says customer number or it says receipt number doesn't necessarily have to be accurate. It just has to be convincing. I mean, I don't know my customer number at my registrar. And I might be hesitant to look at that number and say, is that really my customer number? But not a lot of people are going to take that, that pause and consider. And that's what the Fisher relies on. Now, as many of you are familiar, there are many ways that you fishers can hide tags in HTML email, and these are very popular, and they remain popular, and they're applied today, despite the fact that so many people are constantly telling all internet users that one of the best ways to avoid being phished is to not click on links that you receive in email. In this example, we have hidden tags in HTML, and if you were actually looking at PowerPoint, if you hovered over that hyperlink, you would actually see that instead of going to http://help.registrar.tld, /cgi/bin/php/end-user/ask.php, you would be going to 192.168.1.1 /cgi/bin/php and on. And this would essentially be something that people would innocently click on, and instead of taking it to what looks like the registrar's actual link, it's going to some PC and some, you know, Adelphia cable DSL connection, and on the PC there's a website, and the website is essentially a deception site for, you know, for the fisher to lure you to and for the fisher to collect credentials. That, in sum and total, is the nature of the attack and the nature of the threat. We're talking, almost purely about, impersonation for the purpose of identity theft. Once the identity or the credentials are stolen, misuse or abuse of those credentials to do some sort of malicious activity or to abet subsequent activities. How can registrars reduce this risk? Well, registrars can reduce the risk in the same way that financial institutions and, online merchants like eBay and Amazon and others attempt to deal with phishing, that are targeted towards their businesses. And there's a fairly standard list of, of behaviors that companies are beginning to realize are best practices when they actually issue email correspondence to customers and when they run their own login portals. So to begin with, one of the things we mentioned earlier was that personalization enhances deception in social engineering. So one recommendation that ESSAC has is that registrars should only include information that's absolutely necessary to convey the desired message in a customer correspondence. That means that if you have a choice between including a customer ID number and not, you might want to consider not including the customer ID because that's something that a phisher can leverage. Another is to avoid using hyperlink references in correspondence with customers. This is pretty standard practice among among anti-phishing community advocates who say don't include URLs if you can avoid it. If you do include them, don't include HTML tags because the HTML tags are where people tend to make mistakes persistently. Another is offering up a fact page, frequently asked questions page, at your site and say to customers, be aware that that registrars are just as vulnerable and susceptible to phishing attacks and impersonation as any other online business, and so we know that we issue correspondence to you and read carefully before you actually act and provide the customers with, a set of guidelines for how, what kinds of correspondence you typically issue, what they look like, and so the customer can compare. If you want to step up a bit as a registrar, one of the things that would be valuable is to make it difficult for an attacker to steal login credentials by using a multi-factor authentication method. So a multi-factor authentication method would have an identity, like the customer identity, and a password. But in addition to the password, there would be some sort of token, similar to what PayPal and eBay have implemented, little RSA token ID. And at commodity levels, the larger registrars could probably do this in the same economy that a PayPal and eBay could. And those tokens are becoming, more and more popular. If a token is too expensive, there are other mechanisms. There are soft tokens. There is CAPTCHA. And while all these are not infallible, they at least make it one hurdle harder for the attacker to be successful. There are also some standard transaction processing mechanisms where just having a credit card number is insufficient. Make certain that you use something more significant than just the credit card, and we'll talk about that in a moment. One of the other things that fishers are able to do, because standard internet users or you know, Joe average internet user is really not very sophisticated when it comes to SSL and when it comes to certificates, is to make customers aware that they're using what's called extended validation certificates, so that a fisher cannot just simply use a self-signed certificate and spoof a customer by, you know, by creating the pop-up that the customer always ignores and says okay. And yeah, again, it's almost a segue to what we'll talk about, is provide ways to report suspected phishing attacks. This is, you know, leading to the discussion on abuse contact information. Make it very, very prominent on a website. Make it available so that customers don't have to go crawling around to 12 nested pages to find the contact number or the abuse email address to inquire, to complain to a registrar. This is also a situation where the customer or the registrant has to pay attention too, because ultimately it's the customer who's being phished. And the registrar is being impersonated very hard in the internet to avoid impersonation. It's easier to, as an end user or a customer, to be a little bit more circumspect in who you deal with and make certain that the party that you're dealing with is in fact the party that you intend to deal with. So some of this is repetitious, but from the customer perspective, again, don't click on hyperlinks. Use anti-spam and anti-phishing features. Those software and plugins are designed to learn and appreciate new attacks and new message styles constantly. And if you are using a quality anti-spam product, the chances are that if there is a significant phishing attack on a registrar, that anti-spam software will in fact learn about that kind of attack and will help you avoid it by identifying the message as potential spam. Another valuable mechanism for almost any internet user to pay attention to is that many email clients, the quality email clients, will actually allow you to hover over a link and look at it, and so you can reveal the hyperlink reference that is in the hidden tag. And if it has an IP number, chances are it's bogus. If it is some subdomain under MySpace, the chances are it's bogus. And there are ways that customers can pay attention to this, and this is all standard education. Be suspicious of emails that claim an urgent response is required. Urgent is so overused today that people ought to pay attention to exactly what's being asked for them and pause before they actually click. Okay. Pausing also gives you an opportunity to read the entire email message body carefully. If you read email, many phishing emails are composed by people for whom English is not the native language. You'll find grammar errors. You'll find typographical errors. If you see them as a customer, you ought to avoid going to that site, or at least be careful enough to type in the registrar portal on your own, enter your credentials, make certain that you're speaking with your own registrar, and you verify that you are actually connecting to the registrar's legitimate site. Make certain you're using SSL before you submit account credentials. I think that one of the things that many, many customers do a very poor job of is that they don't use unique passwords. They don't change it regularly. And one of the anecdotal tidbits that we've picked up from the anti-phishing working group recently is that a fair number of registrars, or a surprising number, actually do not have sufficient mechanisms to prevent brute force or guessing attacks against logins. So if you're the kind of person who is who creates an account and uses password as the password, or uses your birthday as the password, and it's a static password, you're putting yourself at risk. We've talked about using credit card CVVs for purchases. This is
joined.
This is essentially a second a second token. Not only does someone have to know the credit card number, which might be captured somewhere else, but he also has to know the number that's on the back of the credit card that is called the CVV. One of the things that ESSAC is going to look at over the next few months, and hopefully will report in Cairo, is that many registrants have high-value domain portfolios, domains that they absolutely cannot do without, domains that they want to have remain properly configured through the DNS, that remain in their possession for essentially ever. Some registrars offer what are called premium services, and those services are typically offered at the very high end of the of the domain chain, the Fortune 1000 kinds of companies. Maybe there are some services there where small and medium businesses might be willing to pay a markup in order to have to make some assurances that they wouldn't be phished, that they would have additional protective measures to prevent abuse even if the credentials were disclosed. And so we'll be looking at that, and hopefully we'll have a report in Cairo on that. And that's pretty much it. If you want to read the entire advisory, it is not particularly long. It's about 10, 15 pages. It's SAC 28, Advisory on Registrar Impersonation, Phishing Attacks. It's available in five languages, thanks to Nick and his staff. And you can download it from the ICANN SAC webpage. So I'll open the floor to questions.
Should we continue the discussion we had earlier?
We may.
Yeah. Okay. What I was thinking, and this is for the benefit of this is Holly, by the way, for other people, our own domain name administrator, which is called Auda, has recently called for submissions, and I think actually the date is closed, on competition policy in their domain names. One of the issues that was raised, and there will be an opportunity for more comments later, is what to do about resellers, because what's become clear is Auda does not actually know how many resellers there are, even though the registrars are supposed to tell Auda. And there's also a consequent lack of information as to what the resellers tell the customers, what kind of complaint service they have, the sorts of, do the resellers' customers get notification of renewals and so forth. So that was an issue, and it seems to me that another issue that was raised by this discussion is also, do those resellers actually understand, and how would they understand the information that's been provided tonight and provide that information to their own customers?
Mm-hmm. So answering the first, or just offering my own answer on the first one, and again, I'm speaking as a member of ESSAC, which sort of creates a Chinese wall from my position as a member of staff and ICANN.
Mm-hmm.
ICANN has a compliance department, and in the compliance department, one of the things that the staff there do is attempt to enforce the conditions of the RAA. It seems to me that in like manner, the RAA imposes contractual obligations on registrars, and registrars ought to have similar contractual obligations with their resellers in order for them to be able to actually satisfy the compliance upstream to ICANN. So I would imagine that any CCTLD could follow that sort of model, and it imposes a certain overhead on any TLD, saying, if I'm going to allow you to be a registrar and you're going to allow Fred to be a reseller, then you must make certain that Fred is satisfying all the contractual agreements that you and I have come to agreement on. And I think that that's actually a necessary step in not only, the compliance in terms of being able to make certain that, that your contractual agreements are fulfilled, but also in just simply being able to make certain that information like this is trickled out, that that if there is abuse, that abuse doesn't come back to a registrar who has absolutely no real way of making enforcement at the same level as the reseller. And I think that that whole area requires some considerable scrutiny now, because we have so many TLDs, and we're going to have many, many more. We're going to have more TLDs in multiple multiple languages and scripts, and the complexity of this system is already significant. The numbers of registrars and resellers is in my mind astronomical, and if we can't manage it now, I don't know how we could hope to manage it 5 years hence.
That's not a bad reply, and one of the points that we made in our submission was, well, surely to goodness there is a contractual arrangement between the reseller and the registrar, and isn't it time that you actually made sure that those sorts of arrangements that are supposed to be followed actually are followed, so that number one, Adam actually knows how many resellers there are, but also that the registrars are providing enough information. And the other thing that we suggested, and it was in the issues paper, was the possibility that OUTA undertake its own education program just for resellers to say, look, this is what you should. We'll have a little information kit here to say these are the things that you should know, and help the registrars making sure that they are telling their own resellers the right information.
Yeah, I think that's an excellent idea, and I think you could actually go even further in saying having standard templates for things like frequently asked questions, and so. One of the value adds of having something like that is that as people adopt the templates, they actually have to, you would hope, stop and take a look at what they're committing when they put the template up, because that's part of their terms of service with their customer. And then they will implement some of the things that they might have overlooked because either they're too busy or, weren't aware. So, if you put together ask questions on avoid being fished, and it says.
I was just going to say, your slide would be something that you'd automatically put up, plus the one prior to that, which is a warning about this is how you can reduce the risk. I'd almost take the text from those two slides and say, look, somewhere, either on your homepage or. The next level down, have those pretty prominently displayed.
I absolutely agree, and I would be delighted to to blog about Ada being the first one on the blog to take that sort of action. I think that's the reason why we do these things. And in fact, if you go back to one of the first reports I wrote about domain name hijacking. Maybe 6 months subsequent to that report, going out to various registrar sites, we started to see people talking about customer locks and customer protection and avoid being hijacked. And so, it's not like ESSAC is breaking new ground here. I mean, most of this information has already come from the skin knuckles of the financial institutions who are attacked daily, hourly. And so, what we're trying to do is provide, provide some good sense and common sense information to the audience that may not really think itself as much of a target as it has as it has become.
Yeah.
See, one of the other things that occurred to me while I was writing this and while I was looking at just all the different abuse that goes on in the name system today is, especially in registration services, the strength and the weakness of the internet is its collegiality and its background in academia, and you have this enormous influx of knowledge and out of the box thinking and innovation that's created in the span of 20 years, something that is so phenomenal and that outpaces almost any other advance in the history of mankind, that it's staggering. The problem is that the trust model that was inherent when there were like 15 nodes and 150 users,
yes,
still persists to a certain extent. But the world is no longer John Postel writing down on a napkin who gets a block of IP addresses and then later on putting it into some sort of text file. And it's no longer, 25 administrators copying, a name to IP, host table every night at midnight. It's,
yes,
so much more sophisticated that the trust models that we could rely on because everybody knew everyone else's name no longer apply. And we really need to step up and be a little bit more aware of how much we put at stake as we continue to persist in having this sort of inability to repudiate origins. And so I really think we've got to pay more attention to authentication. We've got to pay more attention to verification on almost every single level, because impersonation, if you stop to think about it, is the single biggest problem that the internet has. Impersonation at IP addresses, impersonation at MAC addresses, on user identities, on applications pretending that they're someone else. It's really the sore point, the weak point in the model. And the reason why is because the original model didn't really think about that as being the threat. It was going to be a closed system, and the fact that we were able to turn it into a public system is phenomenal in and of itself, but doesn't necessarily mean that it was the be-all and know-all answer.
Dave, it's Alan Greenberg. What you're saying is all true, but the specific topic today, I think, has another dimension that goes back to what you were talking about before of resellers. If we just look at your presentation just as it is,
mm-hmm,
from the title on through the last slide, you're talking about registrars.
Right.
And yet, if you're doing this to enlighten the masses, as it were, every time the word registrar is used, it has to imply reseller also.
And that's absolutely true.
And people don't really think about that. Banks have a major problem with phishing, but banks don't allow other people access to their in-depth records under a different name, which is what resellers do.
Right.
I mean, typically a small user registering through a reseller may not even know who the registrar is.
Exactly.
Never mind.
Actually, most small users don't even have their domains registered in their own names.
Well,
so
there's also that.
Right.
But in some cases, even if you wanted to figure out who is your registrar, you have to be a moderately sophisticated user to do it.
That's true. And I think that's a very valuable point. Unfortunately, one of the things that a slide does is get busy real quickly.
Mm-hmm.
And saying registrar/reseller throughout the slide is something that we didn't do, and it's also a convention that we've sort of adopted in the ICANN advisories. And I think that your point's very well taken, Alan, and in future advisories, I've got to think of a way to emphasize that there are always two models to be considered when we say the word registrar. There is the registrar who is the monolithic agent, there's the registrar who has delegated, so to speak, to resellers. And that's a very valid point.
From the point of view of the presentation, slide number two saying, in huge block letters, registrar and reseller could perhaps address it. The issue is in a lot of ICANN things, the answer is we don't have a contract with resellers, so we can't do anything about it. And that may be legally true. It's not completely, because you can impose rules on the on the registrar itself. But I think it's important that from our point of view, from ICANN's point of view, that we recognize there is a huge problem and start working towards the fix, other than saying just we don't have a contract with the resellers, it's not our problem.
Well, you've got a contract with a registrar, and if the reseller has not been provided with the information they should have and the arrangements aren't in place, then in fact the registrar has broken the contract. And what you have to be saying is, look, you are supposed to have made the following arrangements. You have agreed with us you will make the following arrangements. We would like you to satisfy us that you have done that. If you can't, you've broken your agreement with us.
Mm-hmm.
And it puts the onus back on the registrant to actually take responsibility.
That's all true, assuming we put a legal obligation on the registrar and then we try to enforce it. We can fix it. We know that.
I think that's a very valuable point. And I'll tell you, Alan, I have to give a presentation in 2 weeks at an Eastern European CCTLD conference.
Mm-hmm.
And I promise you that the slide will say registrar and reseller impersonation and phishing attack.
Yeah.
So I will make certain that I emphasize that when I talk to the CCTLDs there and certainly thereafter.
I mean, from
a very valid point.
From the customer being phished, it doesn't really matter who has legal agreements with who.
Right. Yeah. And most of these customers are getting their if they're the commodity consumer level domainers, they're getting their domains from their local ISPs, from their web bundling package kinds of outsources and the like. And you're absolutely right.
Most people being phished don't even know what the term registrar means, so it's...
Yeah.
Is there another slide, Dave, that I'm thinking about that would say if you are a registrar and you have reseller arrangements, then this is probably what you should do, and this is what you should tell them, and this is what should be on your website. And by the way, if you are, ultimately ICANN is concerned that you do these things.
There isn't a slide now. There certainly should be some consideration of that. I've spent some time thinking about that. Maybe what we could do is talk offline and formulate that together.
Yeah, because I'm just thinking that you've got something for the customer. You've got something for the registrar. I'd just put a little bit more on the registrar saying, by the way, if you've got resellers, these are the things that you should be telling them.
Right. And I think that's a very legitimate slide. And as I said, we're at the top of the hour. And,
yeah, okay.
You have my email. Why don't you drop me an email and let's formulate that, and I'll certainly raise it with the ESAC and see if it's worth going back to the advisory and expanding the advisory somewhat to also discuss, what resellers ought to do. I think that version change is good, that when you learn things, learn more about a subject and you can share that with the community, you ought to. So I won't hesitate for a moment in not writing more if we've come up with other valuable information.
I've got to do, let me just write down the email, dave.pisciteo. Okay. I'll get in touch, but I'm about to go to bed because it's a bit late.
Yes, I was going to say, it's got to be very late there.
It's very late, so if you won't hear from me for a little while.
That's all right.
Okay.
Well, thank you for staying up and listening in. I'm flattered. So.
Well, it was very interesting. Thank you.
Me, you're a letterman, so...
Okay, thank you. Bye.
Okay, thanks a lot.
Right.
Bye, Holly.
Bye. Holly Raish.
Left.
Alan.
Left.
I think we're done.
Dave, it's Danny.
Are.
You got a moment still?
I'm sorry.
This is Danny.
Have Hi.
You still got a moment?
Sure.
All right. Just from the consumer point of view, if... we spot a phishing attack and feel noble enough to attempt to report it, I would sure love to have on the ICANN website a list of every registrar's abuse department contact information.
Absolutely. I wrote that down already, and I'm going to, you know, as soon as I get off this phone, I'm going to drop an email to, you know, to Steve Crocker and talk about this, and then you know, then we'll get in touch with, you know, touch with ICANN and find out how we could actually get someone to do the sort of busy work in, you know, in creating that kind of list. I mean, ICANN already has a list of all the registrars. And
yeah, and typically they've only got a single phone number and a single email
right.
listed.
And I think that is no longer sufficient, and that, you know, my feeling is that there should be a database, and it should be something searchable where you type in the name of the registrar of your whoever you think it is. It doesn't have to say registrar, reseller, whatever. You type in the name, whether it's NetReach or anyone else that happens to resell names, and you get you essentially get a response that says, "Here's the contact information. Here's the abuse information. Here's, you know, I mean, it should be something that you can go to ICANN, you know, and I honestly think it will save ICANN hours and hours of call time, because we get those questions all the time. If you ever walk into the ICANN office and you sit at the reception for more than 10 minutes, you will hear the phone ring and you will hear someone, you know, you will hear one of our receptionists saying, "Well, we don't handle your domain account. You have to get in touch with the person, you know, that you registered domain with, whether it's a reseller or a registrar." And they have to go through this lengthy explanation all the time. So I think this is a very valuable insight, Danny, and something that we ought to raise to ICANN.
All right. I guess the only other question I wanted to pose to you was just your take on registrar behaviors with respect to actually enforcing their own AUP provisions. One gets the sense these days that most registrars won't do anything unless there's an actual court order involved.
It's not that bad, and it varies from registrar to registrar. And from reseller to reseller, quite honestly. I mean, I have all my hosting and my name's done, you know, by a small company in Long Island. They're very competent. They're a reseller. They're not on ICANN's list. Anything that goes wrong there, I actually hear about it from them before I would hear from anyone else. That's a good model. Okay, they're a good business. They've been in business. They don't take on more customers than they can. And they run a nice shop. Now, they're probably, I don't want to say that they're unique, but there are probably fewer of them than there are people who fall into the model that you're talking about, where they simply make it someone else's problem until they're, you know, until a court order or a subpoena or something.
Well,
like
yeah,
that.
I mean, I'm looking at the latest correspondence on registrars and their relationship to websites selling illicit steroid products.
Right.
So I guess one tends to wonder these days if the consumer actually does their bit and reports a problem to a registrar, are things going to be handled, or are we really in slow mode?
Well, we're in slow mode, and we're trying very hard to. You know, I'm also a member of the anti-phishing working group's internet policy committee, and one of the things that we have been working with both registrars and registries is what we call an accelerated suspension plan.
Okay.
And in the accelerated suspension plan, one of the things we recommend is accredited entities. So an accredited entity is someone that you trust to present a provable case of phishing. And, you know, there doesn't necessarily have to be a definitive list that everybody trusts, but there should be a list that from which any registry or registrar should feel comfortable trusting. And what you do is, as a registrar or registrar, if you get a complaint from these people, you take action, because the chances of a false positive are going to be very small among people who are in this discipline and practice it. So, you know, from a consumer standpoint, I think it actually makes more sense to go to the APWG or to Spam House or to some other anti-phishing entity than to ICANN or then to the registrar or reseller directly, because the path into the abuse processing is just too slow and it's flooded. And in fact, one of the reasons why it's, why they're slow and they're flooded is the same reason why the WHOIS data dispute resolution process is flooded, because the attackers are hammering those places to try to keep, you know, keep their own abuse, you know, offline or online as long as possible.
All right, you've clearly piqued my interest. Is this accelerated suspension plan directed at the registry level or at the registrar level? Because I'm thinking of the prior language in Appendix S that was put in place by the ICM registry with their XXX proposal. And I'm seeing that certain things can obviously be done quicker at the registry level, perhaps, than at the registrar side of things.
Well, I think both are in play. I mean, right now we're working with .Asia, and they are actually, you know, actually dealing with, working with some people in the APWG on a pilot plan for the model for this, you know, for this accelerated suspension.
Okay.
And the goal is to, you know, essentially be able to take, you know, take domains down, you know, with a mean time, you know, of like 2 hours.
Have you got people from the business constituency cooperating in this particular initiative?
I believe that there are people in the BC who are in the APWG. Yeah. I couldn't tell you the names, but there are lots of intellectual property people there.
Okay.
Yeah, and a lot of, you know, I mean, obviously, you know, the brand owners are the people who, you know, who frankly drive the APWG, because they're the ones who are getting, yeah, you know, just, yeah, you know, crushed by the, you know, by phishing. And so not only are the, you know, the brands themselves represented, but some registries like Afilias is there representing, you know, org and info. And
when we wrap this thing up, Dave, could you shoot me a link to where I can read a bit more about the accelerated suspension plan?
You know what? I'll send you the slides I'm going to use from the APWG, and
okay.
I don't know whether the report is public. I'm fairly confident that Rod Rasmussen from Internet Identity, you know him?
Mm-hmm.
I'm fairly confident that Rod actually went and presented to, you know, to the registries or to the registrars. You might want to talk to Paul Diaz.
Okay.
Because he and Rod had, you know, were doing some work. Paul is on the, you know, for example, Paul is on the APWG committee that I'm on. So there's a lot of cross pollination now from the ICANN community and the, you know, and, you know, the brand and, you know, and other you know, phishing concerned communities. And, you know, one of the things we're trying to do is increase information sharing, increase data collected that helps us monitor things like fast flux and the like. So I think we're trying to make inroads into this. It's a very slow process because it requires a lot of work, and work is expensive. And, you know, frankly, some of the registrars aren't incented to do the, you know, add work and add staff, and others are very incented to do so. You know, there's a big spectrum of these guys, right? There's, you know, two guys in a basement and
yep.
Network solutions, and, you know, so. Yeah, you know, it's hard. It's you're familiar with the whole, you know, the whole situation in something like the GNSL, where, you know, the representation is just so broad. Consensus is, you know, is one of these you know, windmill tilting exercises in my mind. You know, so.
All right. Well, this will be helpful. And
okay, would you drop me an email? And
sure, be happy to.
And I'll try to find something for you.
All right.
At the very least, I can send you the slides I'm going to be using next, you know, 2 weeks from now.
Good.
Okay.
All right. Thank you.
You're welcome.